This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air. How are you?
What a week. What a week. Not too bad. I mean, the week was made a little better by watching your great video that you had shared on YouTube of your incredible, extraordinary, heroic journey back from Southeast Asia. Some might say heroic, right? It's funny because just before we hit record now, I said to you, yeah, it was, I said, the video was great. And you said, oh, thank you. And I said, yeah, like I watched all of it. So, and then I'm
imagining. And I was surprised.
and you were surprised. So I'm thinking, you know, like when there is a movie coming out in cinema and then they go to, they put a statement from a famous person that you know with their verdict and like, and a quote. So I want you to include on your YouTube video, the latest one in the bio, put, you know, I watched all of it, Alex Macheras underneath.
What a compliment. Yeah, but that was a long video. And, you know, last night we're staying with my mom's best friend. So Oscar had the brilliant idea. He's like, let me put on this video and force my mom and her best friend to sit through the whole 45-minute thing. And I don't think I've ever done that before. I was miserable sitting there looking at their reactions in person. I was like, no, this video sucks. Get it away from me. That's how you feel.
No, it doesn't. It was
put
great.
On display like that.
See, this is not a very good advert for your video because you're saying that you, the host, the main character, the sole entity of the video, you found it miserable. Well, maybe that's because you had to relive the whole thing, which was a very, very long economy journey back through everywhere to journey your way back from Asia to Northern Europe.
Yeah. And I mean, basically the context here is that we've discussed the past month plus how it's gotten, or at least I think it's a bit better now, but the first few weeks, it was very difficult to fly between Southeast Asia and Europe if you didn't have a pre-booked ticket. That also applied to Africa, to Asia, to Australia, to Europe, all these different routes because of the absence of Middle Eastern airlines. So there I was in Asia and I decided, let's find a real cheap and adventurous way to get between Europe and Asia, which is how I ended up taking 5 flights through, some would say, more unusual connection points in China in order to eventually get to Gothenburg, which, you know, is already not easy to get to. Wherever you want to get from, it's not easy to get to Gothenburg, but I managed. And I could walk you through the whole journey, but it, was quite the experience.
You mentioned just then about how, you know, people are having to be creative in order to move around, especially with the sudden onset of the crisis. And in those first weeks, specifically in early March, we had people stuck everywhere. And also, I mean, anecdotally, it was always funny. I saw many examples where Middle East carriers, where a passenger booked with one Gulf carrier, which obviously wasn't flying because of the airspace restrictions and so on, because their ticket was, let's say, in partnership with British Airways, and so it was actually a BA ticket. There were examples where BA rebooked them on Etihad. It's like, what? That's probably
good idea.
Not fixing. And of course, that's because the Gulf carriers were in the same boat in the challenge that they faced, and so inevitably the Etihad flight wasn't available either. And then also, I know a few scenarios where people were really stuck because where they were released of obligation from the original airline and rebooked with the additional airline, and then the additional airline then cancelled, then they return back to the original airline. They're like, well, you're not that problem because you're that cancelled passenger. Mm. And so people were being passed around. I think it was a really difficult month for people who had happened to be booked to transit via the Gulf, and the Gulf during its peak can handle close to 500,000 passengers a day in some scenarios, collectively as the hubs, Doha, HIA, Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And that's without the other Gulf hubs too. So it's been an extraordinary time for aviation. I think people will be very much aware of how the situation is filtering out and touching their lives in so many different ways that are not related to air travel. We had quite a lot of feedback of last week's episode where people found it quite sobering. Some of the responses were quite jarring in terms of an kind of a real reality check in the state of play. And we are not here to minimize or to play down the very real impact that this prolonged crisis is having and will continue to have globally on everything. We'll have a little roundup as to where things stand versus last week later. But given that you are the perfect example of someone who has done that journey, and a very interesting journey, I might add, let's talk about how you moved during this disruption from where you were in Asia to Northern Europe. What were the situations, kind of what were your considerations? And then I want to understand all kind of complexities. I've literally got a list that I was taking notes when I watched your video to do with transit visas and onward bookings and so take us through kind of from the beginning.
I don't know about you, but whenever I trip plane, my mindset is always on the long haul flight first, getting between continents first, finding the best deal for that or the best flight for that. So in this case, it would be Asia to Europe is what I'm thinking about. Even if I was starting in Thailand, I wasn't going, okay, I need to get from Bangkok to Europe. I spread my net a bit more widely. And what I found, at first I was looking, you know, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Seoul. And then I realized that you can get a bit more creative, because when it comes to China, there's a whole bunch of cities with 10, 15 million people that most people in Europe have never heard of, but happen to have direct flights to Gothenburg. And no, not to Gothenburg. I wish, to Europe.
Getting ahead of yourself. Goodness, we're just a few minutes into the episode. just for the record, everyone, because the worry is you've just declared that these cities are cities that people haven't even heard of. So now people believe that not only have you never heard of these cities, but they have direct flights to Gothenburg as if. Keep dreaming. I think you've still got... Anyway, go on. So that's an important clarification on the record.
You really can dream about that kind of stuff. Because with China, you never know. There are truly some extremely random routes. So for example, I found one that I was leaning toward from... I'm not sure how to pronounce it even. Zhengzhou or something. It's the airport code is CGO. They have a direct flight from this city, again, probably an absolutely massive city, to Luxembourg. And I found a very cheap seat on that. I thought, this is a extremely niche route. Let's try it. But then I said, actually, that's quite a long flight. It was 11 hours or so. How can we shorten this down a bit? Let's check Western China. And of course, any AvGeek flight radar obsessed person like me has spent hours just traveling around the map on flight radar, looking at different traffic in different parts of the world. And a city that has always fascinated me from an aviation perspective is the relatively big airline aviation hub in Western China, Urumqi, which is the big city in the Xinjiang province, bordering Russia, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan. It borders so many countries on that side of China. And I thought, ooh, are there any flights to Europe from here? Because this still gets us from Asia to Europe. So I ended up finding a ticket I could book with points for the equivalent of less than $300 per person from Urumqi, China, to Istanbul, Turkey, on a once weekly China Southern flight. And as an av geek, those types of extremely niche, infrequent, unusual routes just get me so excited. So I thought, we're booking this and then we'll figure out everything else around it, which turned out to be quite an adventure in and of itself, because as we've mentioned, everyone was looking to fly through anywhere but the Middle East at that time. So flights from Bangkok to almost everywhere in China were also full and expensive. So the first flight I ended up taking was Bangkok to Guangzhou, the biggest hub of one of China's biggest airlines, China Southern. And while usually Oscar and I would probably be some of the only Europeans on any Chinese airline flight, just because there are so many Chinese people themselves traveling, this was a case where basically 50% of the passengers on that flight were connecting onwards to elsewhere in, well, not elsewhere in China, elsewhere in Europe, because this was a reliable way to get home.
From Bangkok to Guangzhou. So then Guangzhou itself is obviously quite an established hub, and also a very close by to Hong Kong. And we, I mean, it's interesting that you pointed out the demographic, because there were so many people, hundreds of thousands of people, that were stuck in Bangkok alone because of the way that the flows between Europe and Bangkok, that flow is dominated by the Gulf carriers, that there were many, you know, it's just so many people that were caught up, and they were simply unable to be reaccommodated in so many scenarios onto other airlines. That's why we saw those network to network flights that, for example, Qatar were operating, where they were flying nonstop from Bangkok to Manchester and Bangkok to Madrid, because it was just about clearing that backlog. And we didn't see those network to network flights from Emirates or Etihad, but they, Bangkok remains obviously, and had remained for them, the priority in terms of addressing the sheer volume of passengers there. So to see that filter out onto just a flight to Guangzhou was very interesting, because you know that they typically wouldn't have Europeans on board on such a route.
Precisely. And what is so fascinating about China in general is how still foreign and unfamiliar it is to most Westerners, because it's been so closed off. And of course, as I said, my mind went to, okay, let's check Hong Kong. Well, let's compare Hong Kong airport, one of, in our minds, the premier established airports in Asia. In the coming 7 days, they have 3,700 flights to or from Hong Kong airport. Guangzhou airport has 5,300 flights in the next 7 days. Shenzhen airport, an airport just a few minutes, basically down the road from Hong Kong. Stone's
throw away from,
They have 4,400 flights in the next days. So Hong Kong is actually the small airport in that region. You just don't view it that way, which is what's so fascinating, because then you land in Guangzhou, where I've transferred before, but only in the international part. The domestic section is just enormous. And what was especially exciting is that Guangzhou is the home to China Southern's COMAC C919s, as you also saw, right?
Yeah, so that was also, I was thinking, he didn't tell me this. He didn't send me a message.
I knew you were going to freak out. I knew you might be a bit nervous.
Part, that part of the YouTube videos where I started to think, oh, and I think that we're in regular contact, me and the co-host, and I find out along with the viewers that you were on a C919.
Yeah,
we'll come to that. I mean, so this was now. So you're now in Guangzhou. You've done the first flight. It was in economy on a 737 Max, right? Yeah. I think that's correct. Yeah. On the first aircraft, you were with fellow passengers that were also stranded and caught up in the situation that continues to unfold, with the airspace closures in the Gulf forcing passengers to find out other ways how to reroute. So, how long were you in Guangzhou for in total?
About a 5-hour layover, which
and actually, have you been to the city before?
No, only transferred there twice. Never been into the city, because these cities are so massive. It's not a little, oh, let's take an easy trip down. It's such a big commitment. So we figure if we're going to do it, we can't just do it for a day or two. we need to really give it a chance. And there's also so many exciting, incredible hotels in Guangzhou. They have the world's highest hotel, the Rosewood Guangzhou. So there's a bunch of things we would love to try there. But yeah, this time it was only transit, which is fun enough. Like, as you saw in the video, Guangzhou Airport has a China Southern cafe. So not only can you buy a bunch of China Southern merch, they have China Southern themed drinks. The people working there are wearing China Southern cabin crew uniforms.
It's strong on the branding. It is. But it's a really cool city as well.
It is. And by the way, this video that I made was when we imported all the files. We had over 3 hours of footage. So there were a lot of things we had to cut out, including so many things that make China the 2026 China that is so viral online. Like, one thing that blew us away was that there's, at every departure board, there's some footstep markings on the ground. And when you step on those,
oh, I've seen this.
And you look up. It tells you your flight information and your gate just by standing there and looking at the screen without having to scan through the hundreds of departures.
Okay, how?
I don't know. You ask me how any of these technologies work. I have no idea. But it's just so fascinating. And of course, there's convenient
things. Now, I'm asking you because you're an American. You know, doesn't that make you feel violated?
I mean, they're probably... They have our faces just as much everywhere in the US as they do in China, you know?
True.
But, and then another small thing that is just so good as a traveler is that every 50 meters in the airport, there's a rental power bank station. So, you know that I can rent one, charge my phone quickly, and then return it in another one of these. There's so many, also Chinese airports have seating constellations that truly I have never seen. I've been to 300 or so airports around the world.
Yeah.
No airports in any other country have the type of seating constellations you'll find at Chinese airports. There are...
And just explain what you mean by seating constellations.
So examples are office spaces everywhere with desks, charging. Yeah. Then you'll find tables with seats around them so that people can sit and dine, even very high walled chairs so people have privacy. There are massage chairs everywhere. There are couches so people can spread out and relax.
You can't help but just feel this, like, it when you spend time in China and in these cities and even, I mean, as you say, venturing into the second and the third cities, you can't help but laugh at how Europe would position itself as somehow being, quote, ahead, right?
Yeah.
And then God only knows what happens to that rhetoric when we start discussing the US and their low ceiling airports, broken. You know, I think even when you were telling me last time about how the terminal I was in at Los Angeles, you were like, this is the nicer one. And I was like, what?
I know. Unfortunately, that is the case. But it's not only there. What I just find fascinating is that you look at the airports around the world that are considered to be the best. Mm. And the Chinese airports are not even... No one talks about them. They're not on any awards or charts.
Incredibly underrated.
But they are so efficient and so impressive that if they were anywhere else.
Spotless.
Precisely.
I mean, you know, the amount of times you could see the amount of times your phone was reflecting in the floors of in the distance and the walls. It was just, the light was bouncing off of everything, because that's how it is when you are in most of Asia. And the infrastructure, these massive terminals, these big facilities, and they are absolutely spotless. Now, arrive to Britain's hub, London Heathrow, and look around for the first few minutes, no matter what terminal you're in. And the filth is too much to comprehend. And it's not, you know, we've spoken about this before. It doesn't mean that it should be acceptable. It doesn't mean that it should be unusual or extravagant to expect places to be clean when the rest of the world is easily able to demonstrate how that is done, how it is possible to have it on bigger volumes and at bigger scale.
And it's not necessarily all due to cheaper labor in China, for example. They have robots going around everywhere mopping the floors in the airports. You get those and you're not paying labor. You can still keep things clean instead of having piles of dried up chewing gum and all you spill drinks on the floors of
accumulated
airports all over.
Dirt over years and years and years that never is, you know, there's just so many parts of Europe that just need one massive pressure washing. It's like those videos. Do they appear for you on Instagram where people are pressure washing? They're cleaning the signs or public transport or...
I also get videos where people go into... let's say an elderly person's home who hasn't been able to clean for 20 years and it looks absolutely horrendous, but then they give them a deep cleaning for free.
That's so satisfying.
It is so satisfying. And I'm like, can we get all those content creators together and just let's do Heathrow Terminal 3 all together now
and
make a video about that.
And Terminal 4 while they're at it, please, because Terminal 4 is a great other. And even, you know, T5 is obviously the nicer one, but still, just don't look down in the corners. You know, the dirt is just, and it's just accepted and that's the norm and so on. And then China is just one of the countries, again, showing how it's done, not just at their flagship, not just the pretty picture for the tourists, but when you venture off of the beaten track and inverted commas, and still you're able to. That's that. I also noted down in my notes, what impressive wayfinding at some of these airports in China that I haven't been to, that you were in the video. The wayfinding is extraordinary. And I say that in simple terms, how crystal clear. Ride-sharing app, this way. Hotel transfers, this way. What a struggle it continues to be for European airports, for example, to just even be at 10% as clear as that for passengers.
Well, we can discuss the C919 flight once I post the video of that, because that was a whole another adventure. But this was when I landed in Wuhan. I showed this because, so this is Wuhan airport. We all know about Wuhan, of course.
How long was the flight from Guangzhou to Wuhan?
That flight was an hour and a half, so very quick.
Okay. From Guangzhou to Wuhan. Yeah.
Yes, yes. That airport is also absolutely stunning. And again, we land, we realize, if you're a China Southern passenger on transit, they have a free transit hotel program. Not only that, you could also order a necessities kit that contained, I wish I could find a screenshot. Let me see if I... Yeah, so here we have it. You can request care and convenience box containing, this list, a free box contains reading glasses, a magnifying glass, a sewing kit, nail clippers, essential balm, adhesive bandages, a mobile phone charger, a thermometer, and sterile gauze. I assume you don't get to keep all these things, but it's just like, yes, this is so civilized. This is how it should always be. Then
I bet you
leave the terminal to get your ride hailing.
I bet it is to be kept. I'm just thinking. Go on.
I mean, getting to keep a phone charger would be pretty incredible.
Yeah. Okay,
then we should have asked for one. But then you leave and you follow the signs for the ride hailing.
Yeah.
And there at the ride hailing, it's like 330 meters to pick up point. And then you follow every 10 meters, there's an arrow that says with an updated number of meters until you get there. Once you get to the ride hailing pickup, there's a waiting room with like a sign showing the registration signs of the cars that have arrived. There's a kids play and changing area. There's seats. It's like, this is just... We sound like we're propagandists, but it just seems like it should be so easy.
Aren't we just appreciating the standard difference in some of these
precisely
other areas? And also I like the fact we have these conversations because we're bringing potentially the realities of
ideas.
A whole market. we're bringing ideas to the decision makers, but also we're bringing the realities of a whole market to travelers who you know, maybe they're living in South America and have absolutely no reason to think about venturing somewhere like that. So that's true for Europeans. It's true if you're on the African continent and so on. So it's good to you know, you didn't just rock up in Beijing for a day. And also, you and I have traveled extensively across Asia, China, and so on. But for you to have taken this journey at this time was particularly interesting because you were in economy class the whole way. So you were not simply wowed by the premium facilities or the fact that you're not coming to us saying the lounge was stunning. Theoretically, you were more tired and achy and painy than previous because you are a guy who flies premium travel because you show people how they can do it for less with miles and points. So, you know, theoretically, you'd think you'd come off of this trip saying, oh my God, you don't want to talk about it. You don't want to relive it, whatever. But actually, you have deep gratitude and appreciation for what these airports are very, very quietly achieving and, you know, continuing to wow us.
100%.
And I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. The one last thing I want to say on this that was just in my mind the whole trip was all these people that are being rebooked or having their plans changed from the airlines that they would have typically flown. I love the idea that they are now probably getting to experience something that they wouldn't have experienced otherwise, to experience a cultural, I don't use the word experience again, but that's what it is. Something cultural, because China is so unique and so singular in how everything operates there. But also to realize that, especially this was satisfying me so much thinking about all the Americans who, you know, I think social media is changing things a bit, but I think there's certainly an idea that the US does things better than China. But if you board a Chinese airline to a Chinese airport, and the flight attendants speak perfect English. They bow during the safety demo to welcome everyone on board. They are so polished, Singapore Airlines level polish of the cabin crew on these airlines. The toilets are kept spotless. It's just so civilized from that perspective. They have in-flight safety officers on every single flight, every single Chinese airline flight to keep people safe. They have a camera recording what's going on their sort of like police have on their chest as they walk around the plane, which is also, I mean, if any country you think would have that, it would be the US, right? No, that's in China. Then you land at a Chinese airport and you realize how grandiose, efficient, and pleasant they are. I think it's just such a fun way to realize actually we're focusing on the wrong thing and we're falling behind, not in the way we think we are, but we need to just be more open-minded to learn from people around us, learn from the countries around the world that do certain things better than us in order to improve what we offer.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head right there because this is, because they are quiet about it. So, you know, there's very little consideration sometimes when we speak to airport teams, particularly European airport teams, there's very little willingness for them to be able to get out there and see, well, who's doing what well and how do we bring that back home. Instead, there's this exceptionalism that extends right across the board and not just well beyond aviation, where, you know, Paris, Charles de Gaulle were too busy picking up awards about how they're Europe's best airport, right, to even consider that China has meanwhile implemented X, Y, Z that is all able to be brought to somewhere like Charles de Gaulle. And it's not that different. There is more that these places have in common than in terms of differences, but than that makes them different. And yet still there is reluctance there, and still there is, you know, not much progression when they could be really taking inspiration. Before we move on to a bit of a roundup as to the current state of play, I noticed in the video that you were messaging about the, you were communicating in the vid about your relief to fly on a wide body aircraft because all the other aircraft were single aisle.
Let's
but
talk
you
about
were
this.
In economy all throughout, and the seat was the same, and you still had in-flight entertainment, and your vegan meals were still confirmed. And so it's interesting, why did you feel such relief that there were more seats in the cabin that were still occupied, as opposed to the same seat with the same scenario and theoretically the same seat pitch and width, but on a single aisle?
This is something we haven't really spoken about. I know we always discuss the benefits and drawbacks of long haul narrow body, which I guess is where this is going. The idea of the A321LR, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea to take flights where you could be on a wide body, but instead you're on a narrow body, a single aisle plane? And it is so apparent when you've been sitting for 10 hours, like I had, on narrow body planes and board a wide body, just how much more made this plane is to spend a long time on. It feels so much more sturdy and spacious. You have far more lavatories, even if the ratio to the number of passengers might be the same. It's just the idea that we have 6 lavatories or 8 lavatories here to share instead of 2, which are back in the galley where the crew are and you're disturbing them, and there's only one way to get to the toilet because the crew are blocking the aisle. Suddenly on a wide body, a lot of those problems go away. You just feel, it feels more premium. It's like we've always said with the A380 as well. Boarding an A380 feels better than boarding a 787 or a 777 or an A330, because there it's like going from a regular wide body to a true wide body. And now you're like,
yeah,
whoa, I can stand fully straight here wherever I am in the plane. I mean, this is especially true for the lower floor of the A380. I can stand up straight while I'm in my window seat in economy. Good luck doing that on any other plane anywhere in the world when you're, you know, my height. So it's just things like that that truly make you appreciate wide bodies. And it definitely...
And what does that say for a future of, you know, more single aisle entrants into the market? Because airlines are being able to be... Airlines are taking these aircraft, offered them incredible efficiencies. But still, now American Airlines A321 XLR has had a bit of a rough entry into service. I keep seeing it's been tech malfunctioning, blah, blah, blah. But also, I just saw this tweet, somebody put, oh, I'm relieved I'm off of that flight. And a person replied, why? And he said, oh, because it was small. And then somebody replied, you know, you were on the newest one. It's the A321 XLR. And he, but doesn't matter. It was tight. And I was thinking, there was, our next booking was connecting onto a 787. And potentially the seat pitch and width is less than what they just had on the XLR. But it's that feeling of headroom. And it is actually why the A380 is still so loved today. Because yes, you were putting 500 people on a plane, but people love and rave about it. And I am worried the impact of this prolonged conflict on the A380, seriously, what that's going to look like. Because once again, it's driving them out of service.
This is such a small problem compared to any of the humanitarian things that are going on. But
of course,
let's just talk about, as av geeks, I have been extremely concerned about just what you're saying, because I see Qatar removing them from the schedule. I see Emirates sending A380s into storage. Yeah. And this is not... Tim Clark, especially at Emirates, has been so committed to the A380, keeping it around to 2040. But there's always been that asterisk there. Every time he said that, unless we have another COVID-like event, which the Middle Eastern airlines are going through right now in terms of, you know, their capacities and the load factors and stuff like that. So it is extremely concerning when, especially Emirates, the airline that has been most committed to the A380 faces a situation like this, because there is no plane that is better for passengers, no plane that is more fun or enjoyable or comfortable to fly. And it would, it just is so worrying to think about what the implications could be on the future.
Absolutely. The situation, you know, is unclear in that sense. We don't know exactly what the future of the A380 is at these Gulf carriers in light of everything that is going on. That brings us to a little brief as to what's going on. We'll start with jet fuel. So South Korea's aviation sector, since we last spoke, has entered into crisis mode because of the fuel supply shortage and the severe price spike of jet fuel. It is continuing to spike. It is unprecedentedly high. airlines are not able to pay. And if they are, there is simply not enough going around to be able to secure it. So I broke the news 6 days ago that Britain's hub, London Heathrow, is the highest risk major airport in Europe in terms of a jet fuel stance for mid-April onwards as the US-Israel war on Iran continues. Just to recap, Dan, Heathrow has 1,300 flights a day, and airlines were briefed how Heathrow would struggle, quote, the most and the earliest with jet fuel as the shortage worsens and the price surges. Quick side note, the UK takes more than half of its jet fuel from the Middle East, and the last known arrival of jet fuel from the Middle East was last Thursday, shortly after the episode went out. There is nothing ahead in terms of shipments and deliveries that has been secured yet. That might change by the time you listen to this, by the time this lands in your feeds Wednesday morning, but that's the situation as of now. And also, just an important caveat, it's not the situation for the whole of the UK, noting that, for example, Manchester Airport, it does take its fuel from other sources and isn't so reliant on the imports from the Middle East. Currently, how are they doing? Well, currently there is no shortage at Heathrow, but I wasn't talking about currently. I'm speaking about what happens from mid-April onwards. A lot of people were. I had so many replies. People understanding the situation. Then I had replies from pilots themselves, British Airways pilots, who were saying, "Well, that's not true. There's no shortage right now. I just flew today and everything is normal." To which I was responding, "Yeah, there's no shortage today. I'm not speaking about what's happening currently. I'm speaking about from mid-April onwards." The president clearly was briefed on a similar thing, that because the next morning, President Trump tweeted entirely about jet fuel. He put, quote, all those countries that can't get jet fuel because of the Strait of Hormuz, like the UK. And then he went on to ramble about other rubbish. But he seemingly is aware. EasyJet CEO now around 9 days ago said, quote, I'm confident for a week or two in terms of jet fuel that we're all good. I'm probably confident for 3 weeks, he said about 10 days ago. Not good. Since we last spoke, the European Commission are urging the public to fly less, work from home and other measures, warning that the prolonged crisis will have severe impacts. Lufthansa is readying plans to ground aircraft as demand continues to drop. Pakistan has introduced a NOTAM, which is a declaration, a notice to the industry. Pilots are able to see it in the cockpit. It's relevant for airlines planning airspace access and so on. The NOTAM notes a very real disruption in the supply chain of jet fuel, and has advised airlines to carry maximum fuel from their origin when they are flying to Pakistan, asking them, please don't refuel here because of these supply issues there. Ryanair have confirmed what I said a week ago and have said that they see real jet fuel supply disruption from as soon as a few weeks if this war continues. The IEA chief said that the biggest problem right now is the lack of jet fuel already affecting Asia. And he says, quote, this is coming to Europe in April and May. That's the International Energy Agency chief. The situation is dire. We've had one of the big suppliers, BP, announce fuel rationing across multiple Italian airports. And that's, again, because of the jet fuel crisis and the shortage that is already here. The jet fuel rationing in Italy that has been declared means that priority will be given to flights for medical purposes, government, and long haul. Short haul, very much at risk, not currently the priority. It's a real crisis for airlines all over the world. Sydney Airport saying that it can't guarantee an aviation jet fuel supply for next month. Philippine Airlines saying that they have some weeks secured, but no visibility beyond that. The carriers that are nothing to do with the Middle East, that don't even fly near to the region, very much affected. It's all a little depressing, I'm afraid.
Precisely. And we got a Q&A question, which I just want to wrap into this because we won't have much time for Q&A today. But the question is about airline fuel hedging and how that works. So hedging is basically purchasing in advance at a set price in order to be able to more accurately estimate your costs. So an airline...
Well, you're protecting yourself from that volatility, right? Precisely. From the fluctuations.
Because as we know, fuel prices change all the time, now we've seen them skyrocket. Fuel is about 20 to 30% of most airlines' operating costs. So knowing what that cost will be on a long-term basis, or at least throughout the year, is very helpful in being able to plan your finances rather than being subject to fuel price changes. So a lot of airlines smartly try to hedge in advance a few years. So Singapore Airlines, for example, is known to hedge several years in advance a certain percentage of their fuel to sort of average out the swings in fuel price and have a more predictable operating model. We have, airlines like, let's see, the biggest, Lufthansa has actually done great because they've hedged 77% of their fuel for 2026. Ryanair, who keeps talking about raising fares.
While they've hedged 77%, that doesn't guarantee their supply, right? So they're locking in the fare to protect themselves for the fluctuations. But the supply itself is that now more yes. pressing crisis.
This is what I wanted to get to. Yeah, so what I wanted to get to is that even the airlines that protected themselves from that and might have initially thought that, okay, phew, this is not, I mean, I assume they saw on the horizon that there would be supply issues, but thinking, okay, we will not be suffering that much from this price increase as some other airlines will, like SAS, for example, which virtually hasn't hedged at all. Now, suddenly, there's a whole new issue, which is, well, great. It's great that we've committed to that we've got a very low price for our fuel for 2026. Not so great if we can't even operate the flights that we had planned to operate with that now very cheap fuel that we purchased, because there is no fuel available, which is the worst possible scenario for all of these airlines, of course.
It's the perfect storm, isn't it? It's just the perfect storm. And of course, this will, to answer a question that we received from Alessandro, this will absolutely impact passengers. It already is. Fares are up and surcharges are up with them. Cathay Pacific, its fuel surcharge has been raised 34% from just the other day. That's the second increase in weeks. It means that a long haul round trip fare now carries a $400 fuel surcharge. Cathay is not alone here. Both Japanese airlines, JAL and ANA, are expected to raise international fuel surcharges to their highest levels for June and July bookings. Air France KLM, closer to home, €50 surcharge per round trip on long haul routes. And that's also applying to Flying Blue award tickets in your world, Dan, with the miles and points, as well as, of course, cash fares. Indigo, similar picture. Korean Air, similar picture. SAS, we spoke about how they've cancelled at least 1,000 flights in April, and several hundreds were cut in March. Most of these were short-haul Scandi routes, where the margins are, of course, are the thinnest. Air New Zealand has raised economy fares, all economy fares across the board, by 10 New Zealand dollars. Domestic, 20 for short-haul. International, 90 for long-haul. It's also cancelled 1,100 flights until the 3rd of May. That affects almost 50,000 passengers and has understandably suspended its 2026 earnings guidance. Qantas, similar measure. JetBlue, they've raised the baggage fees, citing their operating costs have gone up, so they've got to make the money somewhere else. AirAsia, raising fares and surcharges dynamically. Tony Fernandez, very outspoken, said, quote, "We won't be cancelling flights as demand is good, and we'll do our best to try and keep fares as low as possible," but nothing promised about the surcharges there. Fuel surcharges are up on Hong Kong Airlines, Greater Bay Airlines, Singapore Airlines, Thai Airways, Vietnam, Porter in Canada, everywhere.
It's a sad but not very surprising development, I guess. You know, one final thing we could discuss here. We got another Q&A question from Alex, actually. Hi, Alex. He says, what do we think about Trump wanting to privatize TSA in the US? I don't know if you did you read about this?
I did, yes, I did. Yeah. And the problem is I have very little time for anything that Trump is suggesting, because we're in this you must have noticed, along with everyone else right now, we're in this crazy cycle where the markets close disastrously on a Friday, and then on a Sunday we start getting rhetoric from the same reporter from Axios who refers to the fact that, oh, there's going to be a deal and the war is going to end just in time for the markets to open on Monday, only for then Tuesday to be revealed that there are no negotiations. Wednesday, he starts acting out crazy again where they need to invoke the 25th. Friday, it all comes crashing down again. Sunday, wash and repeat. And it's just sickening. But yeah, to answer your question, I see the thing about TSA, but I took it with a pinch of salt because I'm like, who can believe what the president says when he is tweeting in the way that he is in an attempt to, we understand, bring back global stability in light of everything I have just read out. He tweeted on Easter Sunday, and by the way, happy Easter to our listeners that celebrate, wishing you a blessed Easter. Happy Easter to one and all. The president, you would have expected him to have perhaps shared the same kind of sentiment with a nice Easter message. Instead, he tweeted, quote, open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you will be living in hell. Just watch. And I'm thinking, So how do airlines now interpret that to be able to figure out demand and pricing and jet fuel when this is the rhetoric that airlines are having to manage? And I've never witnessed a scenario so granular where the whole world is currently, you know, functioning or dysfunctioning based on what these truth posts are. And I can't call them truth posts because it cancels each other out. There's no truth posts in any of it. Right. So it's just what a mess.
I know. Just talking about the TSA, and by the way, this week's episode is being recorded late on Monday because we were not available Tuesday, Wednesday, just because this situation develops so fast. So we might completely miss something, which might be why we're not discussing that. But the TSA is notoriously one of the worst security organizations in the world. Approximately 70 to 90% of weapons that people bring through security are not even detected and removed by the TSA, which makes you question,
goodness,
what's even the point of having them there besides some sort of deterrent to scare people off? But clearly thousands of weapons are being successfully brought onto flight by gun-carrying Americans every single year. So there's no denying that the TSA is not working well. There's also no denying that most government agencies in most parts of the world take too much funding for too little results, and it ends up being a very expensive, inefficient organization. And the last thing is that the TSA can't keep getting shut down during government shutdowns and their employees not getting paid. But
yeah, none of that is sustainable.
Well, all that said, in my experience, and I think a lot of people would agree, privatizing something in the US specifically usually does not lead to better results. So probably would not lead to less detected weapons or less money going toward the TSA, likely more than it already does. So this is probably some deal where someone that knows the people in the White House is going to benefit a lot of money with whatever happens. Let's also note that the suggestion for now is just to do this at small airports to start out with. The TSA 100% needs an overhaul, probably not through privatization, though.
We'll see. I'm interested to hear what the listeners, particularly those that reside in the US or frequently traveling there, what they think. So do get in touch. And as always, you can leave your comments or your questions to us either on Spotify, where most of you are listening, on YouTube, or directly to us on the podcast Instagram account, which is at On Air with Dan and Alex, all one word. In the meantime,
we will see you all next week, another Wednesday, On Air. Bye bye.
Take care, guys.